morning. Thank you for joining us on Three Women, Three Ways. We're the show that tackles some tough topics sometimes. Today, our tough topic is domestic violence and mental health. Now, the reason I say that this is a particularly tough topic is not just because of the content, but also because of what that means. And it has been an interesting conversation whenever you talk with somebody about domestic violence and mental health. It's touchy. And my guest is Dr. Carol Warshaw, and Dr. Warshaw is the director of the National Center on Domestic Violence, Trauma, and Mental Health. Welcome, Dr. Warshaw.
Thanks, Heather. I'm really glad to be here with you.
Great. I'm glad to have you because this is a topic that concerns me. And I've been working in the field of domestic violence, doing my little bit. I'm not an advocate, but doing my little bit for almost 15 years now. And whenever you talk about mental health, either consequences or, you know, associated with domestic violence, people who work in the field tend to clam up a little bit. And there's a real good reason for that. Have you experienced that? And if so, can you explain that, Dr. Warshaw?
Well, I'm going to start from when I started doing work on these issues in the late 80s. I think, you know, when I started doing work on domestic violence, it was around the healthcare system response in the early 80s. And once that was launched, it was pretty clear that there were big gaps in around responding to the mental health needs of survivors of domestic violence and their children. And we did we started a project in Chicago in 1999, and we did focus groups, surveys with survivors and 17 domestic violence programs in the Chicago area. And they talked about a number of really significant barriers, and some were practical that it was very hard to actually access mental health services. But the big concerns were philosophical, and that at the time and even now, mental health providers didn't always understand the dynamics of domestic violence or the real, very real issues that survivors faced, and would end up pathologizing their experiences and attributing survival strategies to mental health conditions, and not recognizing the role that an abusive partner may play in actually generating mental health symptoms and exacerbating existing mental health conditions. So it ended up being dangerous for women to access the mental health system. One of the other things that would go on is that if women did access services, that sometimes just the fact of accessing treatment would be used against them in custody battles by an abusive partner.
Oh, yes. And that still goes on today. That's very, very common today. So what you're saying, if I can summarize a little bit, is the problem in acknowledging these mental health issues came from not only authorities. So say the police came to an incident, and if the woman were hysterical and the abuser were saying, well, she has mental health issues, the police were likely to assume, well, yeah, see, she's acting kind of nuts, right? But it also went further and deeper than that when it came to talking about domestic violence. Are we still there?
Well, I think things have changed a lot. And one of the things that was really helpful when we started doing this work in late 90s, early 2000s, was the emergence of trauma theory, which was the first only psychiatric diagnosis that acknowledged there was something real that's happening in your life or in the world that's creating, you know, whatever symptoms you have. And it was really interesting because the diagnosis of PTSD in 1980 was actually a political act to give voice to the horrific effects of combat trauma, but also Burgess and Holstrom, who talked about rape trauma syndrome, and Lenore Walker about what was called then battered women's syndrome, which has since been controversial for other reasons.
Yeah.
So that it provided a bridge. So in our early work, using trauma theory as a bridge was a way to have both a kind of a trauma and social justice or political and advocacy perspective that held both this ongoing social realities and the traumatic effects of experiencing abuse and violence.
And if I can summarize a little bit, van der Kolk's trauma theory kind of indicated that, yeah, when you're going through trauma, it does have impact later on in your life. That's a 10-cent version, but that's basically what he said, isn't it? Is it not?
Well, I think a lot of people have said that. And actually, in 1997, 1998 was when the Adverse Childhood Experiences study first came out. And I know you've talked about that on the show already, but looking at the effects of early life stress and trauma on the developing brain and on the long-term health and mental health and social effects of trauma. And I think initially people thought that was due to the mediating effects of alcohol and substance use and smoking, but over the last probably 10, 15 years, it's been clearer that it's really the effect, the psychophysiological effects of trauma on many systems, including the brain architecture, that have long-term effects. And, you know, whenever we talk about that, we also talk about...
We're kind of talking chicken and egg, whereas it used to be that we assumed that the alcohol, substance abuse or the mental health issues preceded or maybe even caused some of the trauma. Now we're saying that, wait a minute, hold your horses, maybe it's the trauma that caused some of these things.
Yeah, and I think it's both. Each one contributes to the other. And I also want to say before we left off the ACE study, which I'm not spending a lot of time on, that one some of the things that have been really exciting developments in the last 15 years are on the concept of epigenetics and how experience actually turns genes on and off and shapes neural pathways. So that the concept of neuroplasticity, so that no matter what has happened to us and no matter what our genetic loading is, that experience can also can both shape things in problematic ways, but also in very positive ways and healing ways, which is why, which is a much more hopeful approach to understanding these issues together.
Well, let's kind of talk back about mental health issues. So we start out this whole discussion acknowledging that this is a tough discussion to hold because we want to make sure, I guess the bottom line is we want to make sure we don't victim blame when we talk about mental health or substance abuse, right?
Yes.
We want to make sure we don't victim blame. I have used this anecdote before, and I think it kind of exemplifies, you know, what we're talking when we say victim blaming. I have a dear friend who, a neighbor moved in, the neighbor's children, she had lost custody of her children were in another state, and she was living with her mother. My friend immediately went, wow, she lost custody of her children, because she, my friend assumed that that meant she had some problems. You know, there was something going on wrong with her, that would be the only reason she would lose custody. And, of course, we know that that's not the only reason. But my friend said, well, I think there's something wrong with her. And I said, what do you mean? Well, she lost custody of her children. And I said, well, you know, that can happen to even wonderful caregivers in this day and age. And a couple weeks later, I got a phone call back from this friend who said, ah, here it is. She's a drinker. And I said, was she a drinker before she lost her children? And my friend said, what difference does that make? But it makes all the difference, doesn't it? We're talking what causes and what results from. And I would imagine that professionals in any field who kind of get that mixed up end up coming up with wrong treatment or program plans.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, Heather, but I think it's actually more complicated. So I want to talk a little bit about, I don't know if you're familiar with the concept of mental health and substance use coercion, which I think adds another layer of understanding. You know, just thinking about substance abuse, we know there are higher rates of substance abuse among women who've been victimized, and we also know there are high rates of victimization among women in substance abuse treatment, and that self-medication is common for managing the internal states and the, you know, traumatic effects of abuse. It may be a survival strategy just to get through the day when you don't have any other options. But you may also be coerced into using or dealing, and that once you're using, then you're at greater risk for being victimized by an intimate partner. So we know that people who abuse their partners do all kinds of things like controlling medication. We hear stories of women being coerced into taking overdoses, then having their partner try to have them committed and then using that against them in a custody battle. Controlling their access to treatment, trying to control the treatment by speaking for them, actively undermining their sanity and credibility in parenting. And then sometimes, like, you'll see someone who would, like, strangulation injuries and the partner saying, well, she was out of control, I had to restrain her. And we know that that works partly because of stigma, that symptoms of trauma are often misdiagnosed as other, you know, like mental illness. Reports of abuse are often attributed to someone's delusions, in quotes, assumptions that having a mental illness precludes good parenting, and internalized stigma. But what I really wanted to talk about was the coercion studies we did with the National Domestic Violence Hotline in 2012. And the mental health coercion study, this is over close to 3,000 callers, over 2,700 callers, and over 86%, these were women because there weren't enough men to make statistical analysis, said that their partners had ever called them crazy or accused them of being crazy. And these are people who called the National DV Hotline who are not in crisis and agreed to participate in a very short survey that they would hopefully be helpful to other survivors. But more tellingly, 74% said that their partner or ex-partner deliberately did things to make them feel like they were going crazy or losing their mind or gaslighting them. That's a lot. And of the 53% who'd sought help for feeling upset or depressed, almost half said their partner had tried to prevent or discourage them from getting that help or taking prescribed meds for those feelings. And then 50% said their partner or ex-partner had threatened to report to authorities that they're crazy to keep them from getting something they wanted or needed, like custody or a protection order. The substance use coercion study was over 3,000 callers. 27% of callers, these are not women who are in substance abuse treatment programs, and in those programs, it's probably the majority of people who have experienced this, were pressured or forced to use or made to use more than they wanted.
We're talking about a heck of a lot of women here who are being forced to use substances, who are being, obviously this is a layperson's term, but who are, somebody's trying to drive them crazy.
Yeah, or like we were recently talking to someone who runs a substance abuse program for women who were pregnant and parenting women, and they were saying the majority of people were introduced into using by an abusive partner in the first place as an opioid program. And of the 15% in the study who said tried to get help for substance use, 60% said their partner or ex-partner tried to sabotage their recovery.
Wow.
Actively. Women will be harassed out of the program, so they have to return. There's constant calling. When they get home, there'll be drugs and alcohol all around. That when the women are, almost 25% said they were afraid to call the police because their partner said either they wouldn't be taken seriously or they'd be arrested, and that women go back and then they are because they're the ones who are literally left holding the bag. So when you think about the implications for both around stigma and around treatment, they're huge. We've talked to judges who are.
You start talking about court, and it can be a horrible weapon, because you have women who are traumatized going into court, and somebody sitting there saying they're crazy, and if they seek help from a psychologist or a mental health counselor or even from their family physician, sometimes those records can be subpoenaed by the court, so they don't even have privacy. Yeah.
So those are why we talk about documentation being so critical and how you connect what someone's experiencing to the abuse. So if they do have to go to court, it's clear what's going on. But we've also talked to judges who do, and DV savvy judges, and they'll say, you know, in a custody situation, it's like not uncommon for the person who's perpetrating the abuse to look much more well put together than the person that they've been abusing for years. And the judge will say, yeah, well, I have to make a decision. And so part of what we're saying is, if someone's bringing that up in a custody situation, that should be a red flag to consider whether this is really part of an abusive relationship. Because there are plenty of people who have a partner who has a substance use or mental health condition, and if it's a supportive relationship, then family rallies around and supports them. It doesn't get used against them. You know, people whose mothers have been hospitalized psychiatrically, and family would mobilize. It wouldn't become a reason to terrorize and further control.
Yeah. Well, you know, you were talking about the judges,
about
and
losing.
I had.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, I had a judge on my show. Well, I shouldn't say that. I had a judge that I spoke to off air, and I said, please explain to me the thinking of a family court judge when you have two people in front of you, one with documented domestic violence in their background and one without. What is the judge thinking when the judge gives custody to that person? And her response was, well, you have to understand that you have two people in front of you. One is frantic, one can't even get a charge of her own life, and the other one is calm and cool and in control. So, of course, we'll give the children to that one, unless the domestic violence is really egregious. And I just about fell off my chair. But what we're talking about is the demeanor that they present in court.
And sometimes evaluations by you know, people who do the evaluations who aren't DV savvy. So, there aren't in dependency court, people, because the risk of losing your children is so high, that they're able to provide services and have people come back. And people don't do that typically. Judges don't do that in custody court, but it doesn't mean that couldn't potentially happen. So there are things that people are starting to think about, strategies for incorporating this in ways that are more helpful.
Yeah.
The other issue is around that how abusive partners actively undermine parenting and the child-parent bond, often, and threaten loss of custody around mental health and substance use, which becomes another tool of coercion. So understanding how all of those issues, when we know that what's most helpful to kids is maintaining that attachment to their non-abusive parent, caregiver. So supporting and nurturing that is really important as well. And documenting, like in a mental health record or substance use treatment record, to be able to document that, you know, that attachment relationship, or that the kids look like they're being well cared for, can be really helpful if records are subpoenaed.
Yeah. So we've kind of covered the background, and especially how perpetrators can try to create or exacerbate mental health or substance abuse problems. But what are some of those mental health or substance abuse problems that we see? Are they all over the board, or do they tend to run similarly for people with the same kinds of trauma experiences?
Well, there's a wide range of impacts of trauma, and some of what we see is what's been studied. So high rates of PTSD and depression, much higher rates of suicidality and suicide attempts, anxiety, panic attacks, but there's also some data on eating disorders and what we see, you know, the exacerbation of any other mental health condition. If you're not allowed to take your meds, you're not allowed to sleep, people are deliberately doing things to make you feel like you're losing your mind. So I think there's a whole spectrum of things that can be impacted by domestic violence. Postpartum depression associated with domestic higher rates when there's domestic violence.
So what do the drugs contribute to worsening, or if there's a substance abuse problem with mental health, is there a causality there, or is that totally coincidental, and does it exacerbate mental health conditions?
Can you say more what you're asking? I'm not, what your question is exactly.
Maybe I'm not phrasing it well. I'm thinking that, you know, the substance abuse and mental health problems don't always go hand in hand. Is there some sort of causality there, or is there something that exacerbates one or the other? What is the connection between domestic violence mental health issues and domestic violence substance abuse issues?
Well, the problem is that the research isn't that sophisticated. There's a lot about correlations rather than, you know, higher rates of a range of different substance use disorders or conditions among people who've experienced domestic violence versus who haven't, and higher rates of a whole range of mental health conditions or symptoms among people who've experienced domestic violence. There's not a lot looking at the intersection, although people may self-medicate with substances for, mental health symptoms. Substance abuse can affect, you know, your mental health status. So there are a lot of intersections, but I haven't seen research looking specifically at that nexus of DB, substance abuse, and mental health together. That's
okay.
More than
and
associational or correlational.
Yeah. Research is ongoing, and there's, you know, some of these areas, just there hasn't been a lot of research. Okay, so
I mean, there's a few studies that may look at timing, like which started first, but there are only a few, and that's why we think the coercion study are really helpful, because it's looking. They're not talking about why they may be associated, just that they often are. So
yeah, well, and there's no doubt the coercion is a hefty tool for somebody to be using against someone else. I mean, the impacts of coercion are substantial in across the board, I would think. So we know that trauma can exacerbate mental health and substance abuse issues. That's clear. Mm-hmm. And we know that a lot of times perpetrators will use substance abuse, or they'll use coercion to exacerbate mental health issues or exaggerate them or invent them out of whole cloth, but they can be convincing. How does that impact victim services?
Well, I think there are a lot of issues, and I'm not. I'll lay out a couple of things that we've been thinking about, and there may be other things that you're actually wanting to talk about. But you know, historically, DV programs had been more when we started doing this work to serve survivors who had any kind of mental health symptoms or were using any kinds of drugs or alcohol, like even taking Prozac might have been a reason to not be accepted into shelter. And that's changed a lot. And now the new FIPSA, there are regulations where you can't exit people on the basis or not accept people into services on the basis of substance use or mental health. But so there's the combination of stigma and attitudes that people have had that have made it, you know, that have, I think, changed a lot over the last, hopefully over the last 10, 15 years. And then there's the, you know, resources and services, like how do you serve people well when they're dealing with a range of complex needs. So there's the issues that come up in shelters that just the kind of traumatic effects of abuse and living in a collective living situation and where it may be more chaotic, you don't have the things around you that are familiar, that you may be hearing other people's stories that are evoking your own. So there's all of that kind of stuff that people have to deal with. And then there's people beginning to understand someone may come in, they may not have slept for days, they may be depressed, and if their expectations that they perform in certain ways or function or participate, that once people have an understanding of how people are affected by trauma, and that they can be much more compassionate and understanding, and also knowing that now that services have to be voluntary to really figure out what it means to work in a trauma-informed way. And services that we talk about, accessible, culturally responsive, trauma-informed services. So it's really survivor-defined, patient, you know, person-centered services. So, like, what is this person coming in with? What have they experienced? How have they been affected? What do they need? What are their strengths and resources? What are their goals and priorities? And how do you figure out how to make things work for them, and at the same time making them work for, if you have a collective living environment for everyone who's there. So, and then there's the issue around substance use, where, you know, again, there was a lot of attitudinal barriers around, we're not going to take someone who's using. I remember early on when we started doing this work, an advocate saying, well, if I'm really stressed, and at the end of the day, I can go home and have a beer, and someone who's in our program or shelter who's dealing with a lot more stress than I am isn't allowed to do that. So people have done a lot, the Missouri Coalition, the Washington State Coalition, around rules and reducing those. And so I think people have really started to rethink how do we make services so they work for people, and or how do we do harm reduction strategies, and how do we support people? I think understanding Patty Bland, who was our dear friend and colleague who died almost 3 years ago, yeah, a little over 3 years ago, really talked about the, you know, how substance abuse is a real safety issue for survivors, and DV is a real safety issue. And we know that DV creates the substance abuse related safety issues, and you can't ignore that and not address that. You know, like, why would we want to be punitive to someone who's dealing with, has a coping strategy that is helping them survive the abuse, or that they had no choice about. So it's really taking a step back and figuring out what we do. And one of the big problems has been not having enough mental health and substance use resources in the community due to funding, or not having service providers who really understand domestic violence to partner with. And in places where people have been able to do that, it makes a tremendous difference. Where, you know, for example, like not letting, if someone comes into shelter and you don't let them in, you have an abstinence only policy, and then they might detox. And when that's not necessary, if there aren't other resources available, when they could manage that in a safe way potentially. So there's a lot of ways to think about doing more harm reduction strategies that would allow people to access the resources that they need. Another thing we've been talking about that a number of programs in Kentucky and West Virginia have started to do is being trained to use naloxone in places where the opioid epidemic is
Okay, explain what that is.
Overdoses. What, naloxone?
Yes.
It's an opioid antagonist. It's what you can give with somebody's overdosing to reverse the overdose, and it saves lives. And it's very easy to use. There's a nasal spray, and the people who are distributing that are distributing to the people who are at risk, you know, of overdosing, or whose friends are, or whose family members are. So there's no reason why everyone shouldn't have access to that. So that's another, just like lots of pieces of things that people could do to be more supportive and make sure that people have the array of resources and services that they need, whether it's in a DV program, whether it's through consultation and referral, or whether it's integrated services or services on site, mental health or substance use treatment program. There are lots of ways to do it, but we have to figure them out.
So we've got some solutions that we're talking about, at least the professionals, that's the royal we here. But how is that being fit in with the whole trauma picture? I mean, I know the whole climate is we have understood what trauma can do, and now we're starting to plug those in, and we're starting to see, oh, yes, there's a connection here, there's a connection there. And I'm assuming that from the time studies are done, and Dr. Felitti, it took 30 years for his ACEs study to become common knowledge, you know. So what kind of a time lag are we looking at, and how are people dealing with, and when I say people, I mean the professionals, the shelters, the advocates, the mental health professionals, how are they dealing and how are they equipped with for dealing with these kinds of issues at this point right now as we're developing this learning curve?
I think there's a steep learning curve. I think, you know, a lot of our work is focused on the advocacy field, so there's a lot more awareness in most states, coalitions, and a lot of programs are doing trauma-informed work, and some of them have programs have clinicians on site who can do some kind of trauma treatment. A lot of programs are starting to use alternative healing modalities on site or, you know, in conjunction with other practitioners. So people are starting to incorporate much more healing approaches in their programs, also child parent resources, supports, and sometimes therapy in programs. And so there's been a lot more of that. There's sometimes tensions around, you know, unintentionally creating hierarchies within programs that are problematic, like who's time or resources or knowledge is more valuable when everyone's is. So you know, programs struggle with that sometimes and are working that out. In the mental health and substance use treatment fields, they're still lagging behind, and that's the next kind of frontier of work that we're doing and hoping to partner with federal agencies to kind of bring that to the fore for mental health and substance use treatment providers. So people are starting to do that work. We're starting to do that work. We're going to develop best practice guidelines, consensus guidelines for mental health providers, and we're working with SAMHSA on developing them for substance use treatment providers. So I think there'll be a lot more out there, but, you know, implementing it is very complicated. The other thing is that we had done a literature review on trauma treatment modalities specifically designed for survivors of domestic violence with Chris Sullivan a number of years ago and Echo Rivera, and we married Ann Dutton, and Camelia Harb and I have been working on an updated version, and we found about 24 randomized controlled studies looking at trauma treatment specifically for survivors of domestic violence, or that explicitly included domestic violence survivors, and the findings aren't that robust because there hasn't been a lot of support for that kind of research. There's a little bit, but so it's often a combination of cognitive behavioral therapy or some alternative healing modalities, some interpersonal therapy, narrative therapy, one culturally specific modality. But I think part of the issue is there are a number of things that are there's trauma treatment in general. There's a lot of the trauma treatment modalities were developed for trauma that occurred in the past and for people who are experiencing ongoing coercion, control, or danger, we don't know what's so helpful then. Like Dawn Johnson has a wonderful intervention that she started using in shelter, but women often weren't there long enough to benefit from the full 12 weeks, and a lot of the PTSD components were later on in the treatment. So she started adding more post-shelter treatment sessions that seem to be helpful. So I was trying to think about, but the issues that we've been talking about are three components that we think are critical for any kind of trauma treatment in the context of domestic violence. One is looking at ongoing risk and the coercion and control. There are many kinds of risk, including socioeconomic risk, housing, food insecurity, kids, jobs, lots of complicated things that impact people's lives that need to be factored in. Plus, if you're actually going to treatment, does that increase your risk if your partner knows about it? The second one is many people have experienced multiple types of trauma. And so that means thinking about some of the more complex trauma treatment modalities that really talk about safety and stability as the first component in establishing a relationship that may be more helpful to people who are experiencing ongoing risk or multiple types of trauma. Another thing when we think about multiple types of trauma is that people experience collective types of trauma as well, not just individual trauma. And one other thing you think about is if people in a given community experience 8 or 10 adverse childhood experiences on average, then that's no longer just individual trauma, it's collective. And often the solutions have to be collective as well, that are really community-wide and transformative. And we've learned a lot of this from our work with Gwendolyn Packard at the National Indigenous Women's Resource Center, who talks a lot about more holistic approaches to healing that really involve often entire communities that are really critical. And I think that's true in other culturally specific and historically marginalized communities where the issues are ongoing and they're not just from an abusive partner, but they're also from ongoing conditions like fear of deportation or structural inequality and violence. So how we approach what healing means, I think when you think about randomized controlled trials, you're often talking about manualized treatments that are protocol-driven and not survivor-driven, and people's lives are complex. So thinking about how you bring the best of what we know and tailor it to people's situations is really critical. Yeah. And the other piece is around really thinking about culture and having interventions really be resonant with what's important for people culturally and culture in the broad sense.
So we start out in our discussion about substance abuse and mental health in relation to domestic violence. It sounds to me like the given, the absolute, whatever you call that, foundation stone that we have to understand is that victims of domestic violence, intimate partner violence, gendered violence, whatever you want to call it, are at greater risk for mental health and substance abuse use. Than the general population. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And we know that their perpetrators will often exacerbate those risks by increasing coercion and increasing sabotage and that kind of thing against them. We know that when
yes.
they go to seek assistance, that's where the glitch comes in, because not all assistants, not all of the shelters, not all of the mental health counselors, and especially if they don't work in the DV field, may be aware of all of this. So is there a problem in diagnosing some of these conditions accurately? And if so, what are the efforts to try and, I'm thinking particularly of mental health professionals, are there efforts to educate mental health professionals about appropriate and accurate diagnosing of these mental health and substance abuse issues with domestic violence survivors?
I can't speak for what all mental health professionals are doing around, and I don't think diagnosis is the most important issue. I think it's understanding
okay.
what's happening in people's lives and how that's impacting their mental health and well-being. I mean, there's a lot of controversy about diagnoses in the first place. A lot of the new neuroscience research is really looking at symptoms and circuits, circuits that
sure.
affect cognitive pathways or affective pathways or fear pathways. So I think it's what's more important is, how are people being affected and what kind of treatment is going to be most helpful. And so having a trauma lens is important. It's not like it's either trauma or it's depression or it's bipolar disorder. It's like they may all be layered together, and trying to understand those complexities and what's going to be helpful is what's important. And so, some of the work, as I mentioned earlier, some of the work that we're doing and some other people are doing is to really try to help the mental health and substance use fields understand some of these complexities and have strategies for what this means to do in practice.
Okay.
So,
if I'm a victim of domestic violence, and I recognize the depression, I recognize the anxiety, I recognize some of the PTSD symptoms, but where do I go for help? I mean, I don't just pick up the phone book and call somebody, right? I mean, are there resources? If I call the national hotline, will they suggest places that I could go? How do I get help if I'm a victim?
Well, I think calling the National Domestic Violence Hotline is a great place to start. I also think calling a local domestic violence program or a state domestic violence coalition, particularly to find out if they have clinicians that they've worked with and that they trust. I mean, that's a good place to start because we don't know who's there in all parts of the country. The International Society of Traumatic Stress Studies has a referral network for people around the country on trauma, but not necessarily with an understanding of domestic violence. So I think on our website, we used to have a guide for how to choose a therapist. And if we don't have it there now, because we wrote it a long time ago, I'll make sure it's back up there soon because we're about to revamp our pages for mental health and substance use providers. So that, you know, to try to get a sense if someone has experience in working with domestic violence survivors, what their understanding is, how they talk about it, if they sound like they're victim blaming, when we started doing this work in Chicago, we did a survey of community mental health providers, and 50% said that if they identified domestic violence or thought that was going on or talked to someone about it, they recommend couples counseling, which we know is most times highly dangerous.
How many said
so,
that they would do that? How many?
50%. 50%.
Oh, yikes. Yikes.
And this was in 2000.
Okay.
So I think, you know, hopefully we'll have our best practice guidelines out soon, but there's a chapter on our website that people can read that's there now is going to be the basis for it on mental health treatment for survivors of domestic violence that people can read. And it has the basic things that you need to know about how to incorporate an understanding of domestic violence into whatever kind of treatment you're providing.
Yeah, wow. I mean, I have talked to a lot of mental health counselors, psychologists, and not too many psychiatrists, but the psychologists especially. And I feel like a traitor because I think I mentioned it. I'm working on my doctorate in psychology, and I just feel like I'm, you know, sorry, folks, but you're not getting it. I mean, a lot of you are not getting it, and I just feel compelled to do whatever I can to spread the word among the professionals out there. There's this whole huge gap in the information that they have, and I know I've given lectures and I've given some seminars, and I've just been floored by some of the responses from some of the audience members. Not, of course, not all, but I would say more than half are just fine, but definitely a high percentage of less than half.
When we started doing this work in Chicago as a partnership with the DV community, advocacy community, and the community publicly funded mental health system, and some substance abuse treatment providers as well. And what the advocates were saying is, you know, all the barriers and concerns. But what the mental health providers were saying, we know this is a problem. We don't know what to do. We need help. So it's not that, I mean, some people are actively maybe, you know, resistant, but a lot of people just don't know. Like one of the things that's been very exciting for us is whenever we present the data from the coercion studies, it's like eye-opening for people. It's like a way to see those numbers and get that how this impacts. So it's this kind of, we talk about it as this insidious pattern. First, there's undermining your sanity and sobriety actively, deliberately. There's the traumatic effects of abuse, then the active undermining sanity and sobriety. Then interfering and preventing people from accessing treatment or sabotaging recovery, and then turning around and using against survivors in court or to leverage them or to control them further. So it's just when you can see that all together, it just opens up another dimension. And there's all the things to think about. And then the recognition that you really do want to partner with DV programs because there's so much skill and resource and knowledge that they bring. Like in my own practice, if I was working with someone who was also working with a DV program, then I could focus on other things. And if they weren't, then I would be doing a lot of the kind of advocacy work around safety and court and all the kinds of things that people are dealing with in, you know, immediately, as well as the psychological effects of abuse and things that they're kind of, you know, the working on as well, or kind of underground, because they can't show that they're actually feeling, you know, better when they're still under siege. So it's complicated. And but I think people, when they have a way to think about it and a way to respond that's better, I think people welcome that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and I think also it's important for friends and family to understand. I mean, I think that, if I may call it a movement, the domestic violence movement over the last 30 years has made really great headway in explaining that physical violence is not okay. And I think you'd be pretty hard-pressed to find anybody in our culture who would approve or even accept the idea of somebody hitting another person in a domestic violence situation. However, once you get past the broken bones and the black eyes, the understanding is a little wishier. It's a little looser. And I think that's where we're at right now. I think that we have made headways, and we have made a great deal of impact on our culture in not accepting physical violence. But I think it's the coercion and the, you know, other than physical abuse that people still don't seem to have a grasp on. And I'm talking about not just friends and family, but also some professionals. And I think that with the idea of this trauma-informed theory, I mean, obviously this is, you know, I mean, it's not, these things just don't happen in a bubble. It's all huge, and the impact is huge, and the, you know, what went into that mix is huge. And so, you know, it's a big task for the professional community to try to incorporate all of this. But when we're talking specifically about mental health and domestic violence, or substance abuse and domestic violence, is the task more difficult, do you think, when we're talking about mental health issues and substance abuse than just in general with the coercive control and domestic violence issues, the non-physical domestic issues, the violence issues?
Well, I think that this really helps people have a different perspective on it. I think it was challenging before. So there was the trauma-informed perspective that helped, and then the coercion. So we talk about a DV and trauma-informed approach, or you know, or a trauma and social justice approach. It's like looking at, you know, there's the impact and then the active ongoing risk, or and the people who are perpetrating that you have to address. So it's not just, when you think about, you know, as I mentioned before, trauma treatment for trauma that occurred in the past, and then it's all focused on, you know, healing, helping that person heal, as opposed to also addressing the ongoing conditions that are perpetrating or continuing the trauma, whether it's by an abusive partner or it's other social conditions and structural violence. Like we talk about, like, historical trauma, that it's not just, you know, it's not just in the past. Like, I'm sorry, my other phone is ringing. I'm trying to.
That's okay.
It's my phone.
We encounter all sorts of interesting.
I'm going to move. So, you know,
no
it's like
worries.
The ongoing legacies across generations. So it's like, and there are real policies that contribute to that. So I think one of the things about the DV movement is it's been an activist movement and has resisted kind of clinicalizing everything. And that's because there are very real conditions that have to be addressed. It's not just, you know, in the person. And so I think for clinicians to hold that in mind is really important. And they may not be the ones who are taking on all those issues. And that's why being partners is so critical if we're going to actually address this in more complex ways. I had another thought that I got distracted from the phone, but hopefully it'll come back. Oh, I know what I was going to say. That I think it's also helpful for people to understand that someone who's abusing their partner is going to leverage whatever they can to gain control. So it may be around threats of deportation. It may be threats of outing someone, or for being gay or lesbian or transgender. So there's like so many different things that people can use against you. And mental health and substance abuse are also things that abusive partners use against their partners.
And it can be used in court as well as personally. It's dangerous. We're treading dangerous ground when we just talk about domestic violence and mental health and substance abuse. We're treading dangerous ground because it's dangerous for women who are in those situations, who are being coerced, who are having that ammunition used against them. And it makes me wonder how on earth we can possibly, you know, if you're a woman who's going through that, and I unapologetically say women, yes, I know men are abused, but not, I mean, the vast majority, we're talking male-on-female abuse here. And so we know women who are experiencing domestic violence, it's a very dangerous time physically, but it's also a very risky and dangerous time for seeking assistance. And not only is it dangerous from the standpoint of courts and giving somebody ammunition to use against you, but it's also dangerous because you may encounter somebody who doesn't get it, who doesn't understand, and who doesn't provide any assistance. And, you know, it's just a very rocky boat to be in when you're in a domestic violence situation anyway. And then if you throw in mental health issues or substance abuse issues, I mean, that boat is just rocking away. And it seems almost unmanageable, you know, from somebody who's looking at that thinking, how on earth could this one person handle all that? And, of course, sometimes people don't. You know, people don't. Right. Not everybody gets through every situation healthy, intact, and on to lead another life. Where I'm looking at the clock here, and one of the things, I'm going to bring up one of my pet peeves, forgiveness. I am so sick of people saying that you have to forgive in order to move on. Do you have, is forgiveness a part of mental health? Is forgiveness crucial for domestic violence people? And I'm just talking your opinion. I know this is a little bit of an aside, but it's one of my pet peeves, and I'm just curious how you feel about that.
Well, I feel similarly to you. I think there's a range of what that means. I mean, I'm not familiar with people saying you have to forgive someone in order to heal. I think they're probably saying you have to not hold on, have your life organized around negative feelings about someone in order to move on. You know, it's like you don't have to forgive someone, but it's what you're holding on to. That's, you know, are they still
And I hate to use that trite, move on, but if you can't step aside from it, if you can't put it in a place and put it on a shelf,
let me take a step back, because I think this ends up becoming victim blaming as well, and I don't want to do that.
Ooh, okay.
I'm just saying that I think there's not a way to heal, and I think most people do. I know you said some people don't, but I think it's really important, and particularly
I think most people do,
and that people do at different times. So maybe someone isn't at one point, and at another point they're able to move forward in a different way. So I don't think to prescribe any way that you have to do something makes any sense at all. I think it's when do you feel like you get to be whole in whatever that way that means for you. When you have people who can see you for who you are and support you in that. And, you know, so there's lots of dimensions to what that means. And
I
just want to say, you know, I know you're talking about that the majority of people who are victimized by an intimate partner are women, but I really think it's important to talk about the high rates of domestic violence among lesbian, gay, and bisexual and trans people. And because when we only talk about women, then people really do feel excluded, and it's really not what the picture is like. I think we've grown a lot to understand that domestic violence is more multidimensional, and that custody issues come up in, you know, for a range of people and experiences. So,
yes, yeah. I just don't want to
know that. I just
dance the genders, you know.
No, I know. I know it's so. I know.
It's tough. It's tough.
Strongly.
But yeah, and I think that this whole issue, you know, I mean, I thank you for the work that you're doing, because just talking, bringing those words together, and I also have been very privileged to have been able to hear Patty Bland present and talk, and she was an amazing woman, and I think that she gave me a different perspective on substance abuse and domestic violence, and you know, she just had an amazing way to bring this information out so that you really did grasp it at least as much as you're capable of. So
I mean, she would tell. Oh, go on.
No, go.
I was just thinking about Patty and her bee sting skit, and how, you know, she had this wonderful skit. Like, if someone gets stung by a bee and they have an anaphylactic reaction, and do you blame them for that? You know, someone else doesn't have that reaction. Like, nobody wants to become addicted to substances. So it's just like all these ways to turn around our perceptions that we may not be even aware of that we're carrying. And if you start from the position of, you know, each person deserves to be treated as whole and with dignity and respect, and are there ways we're contributing to that not happening, and what can we do? I think that's where the kind of trauma-informed approach comes in. But not always in the ways that we wanted to, you know. You know, part of what the shift to a trauma-informed approach was not what's wrong with you, what happened to you, but it's still focusing on the problem. And we really think about, you know, what is it that makes you whole, and who are you, and how can we meet you where you are, and how can we help you along the way.
And I asked Dr. Felitti on the show, I said, why did it take 30 years for this to get out there? I mean, it seems so logical. And he just kind of said, well, I don't know. I don't know why it took 30 years, but it did. But thank goodness people are embracing it now, and professionals are embracing it, and the understanding has grown so much around these kinds of issues. So, yay, Dr. Felitti. You
know, yeah,
yay,
no, that was great.
So, okay, again, I'm looking at the clock, Dr. Warshaw, and I am wondering, can you tell us a little bit about what we can find on the National Center on Domestic Violence, Trauma, and Mental Health website, and can you give that out for us?
Oh, thank you for asking that. Well, I'm going to go look at the website right now.
Well, first of all, that your coercion is there. That's worth going to.
Yes, our coercion study, our lit review is there. There's all kinds of resources and tip sheets for advocates on doing trauma-informed work. There's a series of webinars on mental health, on substance use, on child trauma and parenting in the context of domestic violence. We have a series on trauma-specific interventions for survivors of domestic violence, including some of Stephanie Covington's work. We're about to revamp our page for mental health and substance abuse treatment providers, so that we'll move a lot of our research that's relevant and have a walkthrough, and hopefully have the chapters there now, and the best practice guidelines will be there. This year, there's a wonderful curriculum that Patty developed on substance abuse and domestic violence, plus her Real Tools manual. We have a lot of research, research review on substance abuse and domestic violence. So lots of things that help address all of this, and we'll have more things. We have a self-reflection tool for organizations on doing accessible, culturally responsive trauma-informed work that will be up in the next month, and we're working on an implementation guide and webinar series to go with it that will start in the spring. We're working on a research and policy brief on opioids and domestic violence that should also be out this spring. So we have a lot of things, and we'll have more as we go along. There's a wonderful guide for engaging children and parents.
Yeah, you guys do a lot. I often go to the website, and you've got it up there. Can you give out the website so that people know? Because you don't have to, it's just NCDV.
No, it's National Center DVTraumaMH.org, but if you did NCDVTMH.org, it would direct you to our real website. So National Center DVTraumaMH. And we have a Twitter, it's Instagram and Facebook, and Angelica Medina from our staff, who does lovely graphic social media things that I'm just learning about. Has some recently did a campaign, an anti-stigma campaign around deviant substance use for Domestic Violence Awareness Month on our Instagram account. So
wonderful. Well, it's a wonderful website, and what I like about it is that, you know, for people who work in the field or if you're not in the field, I mean, you can get information from there. And I will actually, I'm often approached by people saying, well, my sister-in-law or my mother or somebody, you know, I'm concerned that they're experiencing domestic violence. I will actually send them to some of these websites so that they can become more informed about this whole thing in order to be more helpful and also have more resources up their sleeves to help their friend. So... one other quick thing I wanted to say to you, which is I wrote a book. Gosh, it's been a long time ago, and it's, and, you know, I mean, you can still get it, but it was a long time ago. But I noticed on your LinkedIn page that you were friends with Barbara Hart, and I wanted to tell you that Barbara wrote an introduction to my book.
Oh, wow. Wow.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
great.
That was a long time ago. So we have three degrees of Kevin Bacon or whatever. We kind of have a 3 degree of, you know, something here. Anyway.
Yeah.
I thank you so much, Dr. Warshaw, for being on this show and for talking about this complex issue and also just talking about trauma in general. I appreciate the website. I'm really looking forward to learning more and seeing some of these things when they come out. So thank you so much for being with us and sharing some of your thoughts, some of the research, and letting us know what's going on there. So thank you, Dr. Warshaw, and you can join us again next week on 3 Women 3 Ways.